I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome back to another edition of the Friday Golf Podcast. It is here. We are here. It is Masters Week. This whole week, I will be in Augusta National. We are so excited for the 88th playing of the Masters. We are going to have a ton of stuff going on at the Bedratty House, live from there as well. We will be on the grounds this week with a couple of us there. And we'll be pumping out content through the newsletter. We'll be putting up a lot of website articles. And then, of course, podcasts. Between this podcast as well as the Shotgun Start, we will have all of your Masters needs covered. So to get to the Masters, I want to call up one of my favorite people to talk golf with, Trevor Immelman. Trevor is the lead analyst for CBS. He is also a past champion of the Masters. So an absolute pleasure, honor to talk with Trevor about the 2024 Masters tournament. So we did our traditional five things podcast where each of us prepares kind of five things that we're watching for the Masters. We had some overlap. It was a great discussion. Trevor was, as you'd expect, prepared and really great in this format. So I'm excited for everybody to listen to this podcast. And just, you know, if you don't subscribe to the newsletter, subscribe this week. If you don't, you know, kind of follow our website often, we should have a lot of stuff up there. We have a whole page that's dedicated towards our Masters content. And then I think we're going to have a lot more social media content this year. We'll have a photographer on the ground at the Masters, and excited for that. That'll be a first time for us having, you know, images that we can share from Augusta National. So before we get to Trevor Immelman, let's talk about the Dratty House. Bedratty, longtime partner of ours, is the presenting sponsor of this week. And Bedratty is awesome. They've outfitted us with a ton of gear and the house with just a ton of goodies. So Bedratty, be sure to check out Bedratty.com. It's spring. It's time to check out. Time to look through your closet. You know, it's always nice to refresh, and it's spring, the new season's here, get a little refresh. I just was at a golf course. I was at Brambles up in Northern California, and I was looking around their pro shop. They had a bunch of Bedratty, but you know what I got? What I purchased full price from the pro shop? An everyday vest. This is one of my favorite pieces. It goes, you know, goes well with everything. It's April. It's a great layering piece. You're at that time of year where, you know, even if your highs are in the 70s, your lows are going to be in the 40s, 50s. It is perfect for your, like, walk to work. If you're walking the dog, this thing you will wear a ton. So I just picked up a new everyday vest. If you visit Bedratty.com, we have a great promo code. It's TFE30. It's 30% off. I mean, you can get some pretty good dollars off if you use that promo code. We have, you know, if I was going to recommend a couple things, everyday vest, Liam Polo. I love the Russ hoodie. I wear that a lot. I love the Russ crew neck too. Those are two things I wear a ton. But big thanks to Bedratty and their support of our coverage of the first major of the year here. So visit Bedratty.com, and now to Trevor Immelman. Trevor, welcome back on. You were nice enough to join us last year for this the same episode, and excited to talk about the 2024 Masters here. To kick things off, I would love if you could take us back to your first Masters. Where were you when you found out you were in the Masters? And if you could just talk about that first time around Augusta National, what you felt and what stuck out to you about your first Masters?
Well, Andy, first of all, it's awesome to join you. Huge fan of the pod. And, you know, this time of year, you can probably, if anybody has the opportunity to watch this, you can see the huge smile on my face. You may even be able to hear it in my voice. Like, this is the time of the year that really gets me going, leading up to the first major, to the Masters. This event has meant just so much to me in my life. So it's interesting you ask that question, because I have so many amazing memories and recollections from over the years. First time I played actually was in 1999 as an amateur. So how I found out that I was qualified or going to be invited was winning the Pub Links at Torrey Pines. And the year before, the summer before in 98. So I had like this countdown period from winning the Pub Links to that first Masters as an amateur. And it was a thrill. I was able to get some invites on the South African tour and the DP World Tour. Back then, the European Tour, to, you know, try and get some more experience under my belt playing at the highest level. And, you know, those months leading up was a lot of fun, trying to work on my game back in South Africa and get things ready. And I'll never forget, I played in the end of January. I played in Dubai, the big tournament in Dubai on the European Tour. And then the week after that, the Middle East swing back then used to have Dubai and then Qatar back to back. So I played those two as an amateur. And then I actually flew from there to Augusta to play my first practice round. So this is now early February. And the excitement on this massive trip and flight from the Middle East all the way to Georgia was just like, I could not wait. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't rest on the plane. I just wanted to get there. And I was fortunate enough to be hosted by a member, the Hempel family. And I actually stayed, believe it or not, in Butler Cabin for those couple nights that I was there. And once again, you know, once you get on site and you find out, well, you're actually staying in Butler Cabin, the way I felt about that, I mean, it's hard to even describe. You know, 1986, when I was just 6 years old, is the first Masters I watched on TV back in South Africa. Got permission from my parents to stay up past midnight and watched it and was totally enthralled. I mean, everybody that knows anything about golf knows the 1986 Masters. And now here I am as a, whatever, 19-year-old kid staying in Butler Cabin about to play Augusta National for the next 2 days. So got up early, hardly got any sleep, played 36 holes for 2 days in a row. And then I had a couple months to get ready. And then once I got to the tournament, it was just, you know, kicked up a notch, because now you're nervous, you're anxious, you're trying to figure out how you can make the cut.
Do you remember after you played those practice rounds of 2 days of 36 holes, what you took away? And you said you had a couple months to get ready. What did you, from your first time around there, zero in on what you needed to get ready?
Well, first of all, it's the elevation changes that absolutely catch you off guard if you have not been there. Look, nowadays, and I'll say this because I work for CBS, nowadays we do an amazing job really trying to, and also with the technologies that have improved from the 80s until now in television, to be able to show that undulation a bit better and try and give viewers at home a bit more of a grasp of it. But when you think back to the 80s and when really they only used to broadcast the second nine and you couldn't always get a real feel for it, but now the technologies are so good. So yeah, that's the first thing.
I'll say this as someone who's a part-time photographer. There's no way to capture what you see and feel with the elevation there in a photo. There's no way. There's no way to do it. Like, it's gotten, I will echo what you said, the telecast has gotten leaps and bounds better. Every year it gets better. I mean, you see the guys with the ground cameras running around,
yep,
trying to get that, you know, those ground shots looking up at these perch greens. but it is un, and I know this gets like beaten into the ground. Nothing, I will say, nothing prepares your eyes for the first time you're there, and nothing when you're inside the ropes on the golf course, nothing prepares you for the what your feet feel. What your feet feel when you get on some of the greens and when you're hitting those shots is just discomfort.
Yeah. So that's exactly where I was going. That elevation change transcends into having to hit so many shots from uneven lies. And you just don't get that very often anymore, do you? You know, you just don't. And really, even when you're practicing, you know, either off of a mat or off of a driving range tee that's pretty flat. And leading up to the Masters, you really have to seek out places where you can go and hit balls from downhill, uphill, side hills, and make sure that you still have elite distance control off of these slopes. Because at the end of the day, one of the keys to unlocking Augusta National is distance control and preciseness with your approach play. Because if you want to have a decent look at birdie, you know, you've got the size of a mid-sized rental car to land your ball in. And that's tough enough to do off of a flat lie. Now you've got some elevation to deal with. You may have 5 or 10 miles an hour of wind to deal with and an uneven lie. It's difficult. It's difficult. Never mind being nervous. So you got those things, the elevation, and then just the green complexes and understanding the patterns to those and ways to put yourself in a spot to where you can try and make a few birdies and at the very least keep the big numbers off your card.
Did you have a favorite place or spot to practice those uneven lies that you found? Was there something you did, not necessarily your first time around, but in your prime where you went to a specific spot to practice uneven lies?
Well, I would do it all in weeks preceding. And, you know, for the most part around that time, I was hanging out a lot at Lake Nona here in Orlando. And there were many areas there we could just go and find a spot, drop a few balls and, you know, see what the ball does when it's a foot above you or the downhill lie. You know, some shots really jumped to mind that people who haven't stood out in the fairways, haven't had that opportunity, may not quite grasp. First of all, the second shot into 13, if you're going for it, that ball is at least 12 inches above your feet and more in places. So now you're trying to pure a long iron. And now, you know, we're back to being mid and long irons after they moved the teeing area back last year. But, you know, we'll pretend that I'm still getting ready for 99. You got a long iron or maybe even a fairway wood, and you've got to catch it so pure in order to make sure you get over Ray's Creek. And it's not easy to do. I always found that the second shot at 13 played a club longer than the number. And I think it's because you just don't get perfect contact because the ball is so far above your feet. And when you do catch it good, it's inevitably got a little hook to it. And then you're bringing those bunkers into play or that little swale that's not always easy to get up and down from. That's one that you got to be ready for. And then the wedge into 15 off of that downhill lie. I mean, that is just, you know, you got to be careful. It's easy to pick the club up a little too quick on your takeaway. And then you hang a little too much on your left side. And then if you keep going with it, that ball flights in a little bit too low. And then the first bounce is too big and it jumps over the back. Or you rock back a little bit because you can feel a little too much weight on your left side. And then you don't quite get contact. You see guys land it on the front, spin it back into the pond. I mean, those are shots you just have to be ready for. Second shot into 9 is another one. Big, big downslope there. Hitting to an elevated green. So the green's above you and you're on a downslope. Got to be, not just have great skill, but you got to be very committed mentally in order to pull those shots off.
I think like you hit on a few of the shots that are just, you think about like the nuance of the shot into 13. Also, you have this lie that is going to make the ball go left, but you know, in golf, one of the amazing things about golf is a wedge goes more left off that lie than a 7-iron. A 7-iron goes less or more off left off that lie than a 4-iron. It is like it goes through the bag, and the longer the club you have in there, you feel like it's going to go left, but that club, like more often than not, kind of hangs a little more right than you think. And it's just, you know, the degrees of this, the wedge shot. I mean, the downslope wedge is one of the hardest shots, and then the green that they pair with it is the most punishing, most precise green on the golf course. It is, you know, like the shot you just highlighted into 9, the side slope downslope into a green that's perched up. It's that, you know, you're hitting that wedge shot, and it's going to come out a little bit lower, but you're hitting to this elevated green, and then the worst miss that you can make on that green is long. You
That's
know?
Right.
And it's just, and your tendency is going to be to miss long there. It's just, I think like when I think about that golf course, it's just how the greens and the orientation, the slopes of them pair with the land that you're approaching from is unmatched. There's no golf course in the world that pairs that dynamic of the ground and what it makes you feel and what the tendencies of those shots are with pairing the worst places you could be on the green or around the green, you know, with the tendency of the lie. Like it is psychological warfare from the second you step on the course and that first green.
Man, that's beautifully put. It's a masterpiece. I mean, there really is no other way to describe it. And you know, when you were talking about that second shot into 9 now, I was thinking to myself, yeah, and never mind that. You also have the green that sits at a slight angle. So now it challenges your tee shot. If you hit it down the left, you're going to have to come over those bunkers and the green is more shallow. Or you can try and push your tee shot down the right and then be hitting more up the angle of the green. And then, oh, by the way, there's 3 levels to that green as well.
And also, if you come up a little short, it's going to roll 40 yards back down.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's the best. The tournament is incredible. The traditions that they have there are unmatched. I mean, there is just nothing like it. I tell you what, the person who wins this year, this is going to be the 88th Masters. That has a nice ring to it, 8-8. So, chapel for that one.
It's, you know, as you get, I feel like as you get older, years become less of an obstacle. I just, you know, you saying that, I didn't realize how close we were to the 100th. That's going to be a spectacle, you know, when you think about it. As we're getting close to that. So, 88th Masters. Last year when we did this, you were upset. About
well, you cheated. That's about, fine.
A couple of things. You were upset about the prep. This is our 5 things episode. You didn't complain about it this year. In the lead up, you know, I didn't know if you were saving them for the pod, but I definitely cheated again. But I set the rules, and one of the things you could do, like I might just be a little bit more experienced. I know the nuances of listen. Like if you can come up with a broader topic, you can lump 4 storylines into 1 topic.
Yeah. I think I've learned from my experience with you last year. Also, I recently listened to a pod with you and Bacon where you did the same thing to him. You put 4 or 5 things into one topic, and I was like, man, this is obviously Andy's go-to move when he has people on the pod to talk about their 5 favorite things. So, you know, I've got a little something up my sleeve for you.
All right, let's kick it off. What's your first thing you're excited about or first storyline? I don't really know what the right bucket is to say these. What's the first thing you're
watching? Okay, but before I get to the first thing.
All right. See, you're already getting more things in here.
Yeah, so then maybe this is number 6. But Weather.
This is on my list.
Weather is all I'm interested in right now. I'm checking the forecast twice a day leading up, and I am just so hoping for a lot of sunshine this week in prep up there, and then once the tournament gets going, some more heat and sunshine. Because it feels like it's been a little while since we've had a real firm and fast Masters. And because of all the nuances and the things that you and I have just outlined about the brilliance of the course design, when it's firm and fast, this Augusta National comes alive even more. And when that ball is running, the drama that goes along with that, the anticipation that goes along with that, the excitement of that ball rolling on the ground just increases exponentially. So like, before I get to number five, weather is something I'm very interested in.
Listen, this was on my list. I think the forecast right now looks really great. I don't want to jinx this. Since you've been broadcasting, it's just been dire. I mean, last year was horrendous. The year before that was bad. Even if you go back to Tiger's year, you know, it was an amazing Sunday, but the Sunday happened hours before when it was supposed to happen, you know, because they moved up the tee times and it was a morning. So it wasn't a real Master Sunday. You think about that, that win, the win was amazing. It was an iconic Master Sunday, but it didn't happen on the afternoon of Master Sunday. I completely agree. Do you have a memory of Augusta National when it was really fiery and a shot or something that was like, whoa, that's different?
You know, knuckling down the rounds or what year it was, because I've been going there so long, is harder for me to do. But, you know, you start to get the feel on approach shots when the greens, you know, they have phases of firmness. The last few years, like you say, it's been pretty green. And they can go a little yellowy, a little purple at times when it starts getting really firm. And, you know, there's a bunch of approach shots you've got to be really careful with, starting right at number one, which is the highest point on the golf course. That green, if it's firm and fast, gets baked out. And it is one of the most intricate and complex greens on the whole golf course. I mean, the areas that you have to play with there are tiny because of that false front and that funnel in the front of the green. Five is another one that gets really firm. You start getting back right hole locations at six that you're just wondering, how on earth am I going to stop the ball up on that little plateau? Seven hitting uphill as well. That ball is bouncing as high as the flag, and you've only got like 11 yards of depth to work with. So you're in a panic over that second shot hitting off of a downslope. You know, there's lots of areas where you've got to be real careful. And that's what I'm really hoping for and looking forward to, because that's when you need supreme control over spin and trajectory. And that's what I'm hoping.
Spin trajectory, it's got to get to the fraction of where you hit it on the face. If you catch it a little on the toe and it's got just that fraction of hook spin, mm-hmm. you're not going to find that right, that perfect spot. And I think sometimes, you know, with golf, we watch these leaders and they make it look so easy, but the reality of how perfectly struck on a firm golf course, how perfectly struck a shot has to be to get to some of these areas that they get to, gets obscured just by, you know, they hit the shot and it's like the shot that goes, that's 15 feet right of a flag from a bad angle with a firm green. It's like those shots, because they aren't 3 feet away, get obscured of like just how freakishly good that is. And I feel like that's something that you really pick up when you're on the ground at an event and you see, or in your case, have played the event. Like, you know, I've been there. I know how it feels when I'm standing over that shot and thinking, I have to hit this absolutely perfect to get it to 15 feet.
Yeah. And you don't need to remind me about those last few years. 2019, I was actually playing. And because we played early, I teed off the 10th tee on Sunday.
Oh, God.
And here's
early morning.
Here's a useless piece of trivia for you. In all my years at the Masters, twice I've teed off the 10th tee. The third round in 2005, I shot 65. And the final round, 2019, I shot 69. So I've actually got a pretty good scoring average teeing off the 10th tee at Augusta National. There's something I'm sure you didn't know.
I gotta say, I think that if they had stuck with the original routing, 10 was one.
Maybe I'd have won more green jackets.
Yeah, you might be like a six-time champion.
Yeah. There's two guys that would have a huge say in that, Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods. So they've done pretty well at that tournament, not giving many other guys a great shot. But and then 20 was the COVID year, so we played in November, and it was completely different golf course. And then, like you say, last year we had 28 holes on the Sunday. It was that marathon on Sunday after all the rain, and the course was pretty soft. So, yeah. Really hoping for a firm one.
I can't remember. I feel like we've gotten a round or two of really firm conditions, but I can't remember the last time we've had a four-round tournament where we haven't had weather come into the equation. You know, I can't remember the last time.
Right now it looks really good. It looks pretty solid this week, all the way through the weekend, all the way through really Wednesday. Then Thursday, Friday, there's a slight chance. And then it looks pretty good on the weekend again, which obviously we're excited about at CBS. That's when we really get to show off, is when it's bright and sunny.
All right. I'll do one since, you know, you already knocked one of mine off. But what I'm extraordinarily excited about over the last really 3 years of golf, it's we've had these kind of side storyline, sometimes dominant storyline of what's going on with LIV and the PGA Tour. This year's no different. But what I love is this week, it more so than every other week, becomes all about the golf. We're zeroed in on the golf at hand, the major championship, the first major of the year. All the top players are here, and really, you know, what the tournament becomes is the tournament, unlike so many other tournaments, isn't viewed through the context of money. It is it is viewed through the idea of history and legacy. And I just think when golf tournaments are rooted in that, and when you make the turn on the back nine on Sunday, or you're on the sixth hole on Saturday and you're in the mix, there is an added weight, an added thing that is in your mind and you're thinking about, and it is about becoming a player that will not be forgotten in history, along with the big winner's check and all the things that happen. But it is really about becoming a Masters champion, and to me, this is when golf thrives. This is when golf is the best. And I in the last 2 weeks, I've just become so smitten knowing that this week is coming because of this dynamic.
Yeah, that's very well said. I'm right there with you. Look, the last 2-3 years has been exhausting, completely exhausting. And to feel like we're going to have this moment in time where hopefully all of that is, thrown onto the back burner, and we can just focus on a golf tournament that really transcends the sport and a magnificent golf course for, like you say, playing for history and legacy, and to see somebody put on the green jacket, whether it be their first time or another opportunity they get in to do it. If you think of some of the other players, that is something that really does excite me. I'm right there with you.
Yeah, and it's like I always think about when I think about this. I know you've worked with him. I always think about Curtis Strange's kind of back nine in 85.
Yeah,
and he had. I wish I pulled the quotes, but he talks about he has some great quotes about when he made the turn, where you know he makes the turn and he got on the 10th tee and everything just felt different, you know, and all of a sudden it was hard and sure, like he didn't end up winning. Curtis was a great, great player who didn't get a green jacket that you might look back on history and say, that's one of the guys that should have gotten a green jacket that didn't. Yep. And yep. There's just so many, you go through the time there's something about Augusta National where certain players are just like, it's like they're blessed by Augusta National and other players get kind of snake bitten by it. And there's a whole other mental hurdle that you have to overcome. And it's just so rare. And there is like, you know, I think there's something to be said about tournaments. And I think this has really helped the players over the last two decades, tournaments that come back to the same place all the time. And what it does mentally to players is there's those built-in memories of, hey, you know, 4 years ago, I hit this shot here that just stay rooted in their head. There's good memories and you get these positive, warm, fuzzy feeling memories, or you can get these negative memories where you're remembering, oh, that day, that third round Saturday, I was three shots out of the lead and I hooked it in the water on 11. Mm. And there's a power to returning to venues.
Yeah.
It's why I think sometimes it's hard to play tournaments at your home course because you remember bad shots you hit there.
But also what I've found is, when you play your home course, you're not always as disciplined and your mind is not always as cluttered and you just play. But then all of a sudden, if you've got a tournament there and you walk onto the tee and you pull out driver and you're like, whoa, I'm actually like, this means something now. You know, there's that lake is down there, and you know, if I hit it in there today, it means something. There's something interesting about that as well. I remember going through that the two South African Opens I won was actually at my home golf course, and that experience was pretty weird mentally, having to actually play the course in a slightly different manner. And that's, you know, I'll come back to that a little bit when I get to one of my other players here that I'm going to talk about. But you're right. You know, you think of legends of the game that haven't won at Augusta, you know, Weisskopf, Trevino, Ernie, Rory. You know, it feels like those players absolutely should have been able to win the Masters. But it's one of the million threads of this tournament that just makes it so great is that you have the Norman is another one that's just jumped to my mind.
Yeah.
You have the amazing stories of the Palmers and the Mickelsons and the Woods and the Sevies and, you know, the players and those guys that were expected to win and won multiple
Jack.
Times. Jack, yeah. Obviously. I mean, that goes without saying. But then you have these other legends that didn't ever find a way to unlock that something around there. And like I say, it's just one of the many things that makes this tournament great.
If you think about Augusta and in the context of an elite professional golfer, you know, they all make these like scouting trips where they play maybe two, three, four rounds. In addition to the practice rounds leading up, Augusta National, they play over the course of, say, 15 years of their prime career or 10 years. Augusta National, they play probably the most golf at outside of their second golf course.
Mm.
Or outside of their home golf course.
True.
They do not fly out to play the Travelers, you know, a month in advance. Like they play their usual tournament prep there. Augusta is the place that they play an extra round or two here or there. They might play it seven times in a year or eight times in a year. And that's probably the course that they log the second or third most rounds year in, year out.
That's a good point.
And it's just something dynamic where for these guys, they are more familiar, and familiarity has great benefits. I think it's like Harrington's great quote a few years ago, experience isn't all it's cracked up to be. Like, you know, sometimes like it's bad. Like
that's right.
You get the bad memories and there's good things about it and bad things. There's drawbacks. And I think that's something that when you have a regular, that's the only regular major host, and that's part of what makes it more special than the others, is the familiarity of the course, not only for fans, but for the players.
Yep. Totally. All right. So now I'm going to start with my actual number five.
All right. Number five. And you're counting down? Five down?
Yeah. I'm going from five to one.
All right. I'm already two in. So you've got more than me.
So Tiger Woods is my number five storyline leading into this 88th Masters. Somehow, he's actually coming in to this Masters with less golf under his belt than he did last year, which is just fascinating. He's had 24 holes competitive golf as prep for this Masters. At least last year, he played all four rounds in LA, made the cut there, had a good round. I think either it was the second or the third round, and got a little momentum. But this year, went to LA, got sick, only played six holes on the Friday, and so he's even more undercooked than what he was last year, which is fascinating. And the reason I've got him at number five, first of all, look, I mean, there's just no player that even comes close to the fame and the juice that Tiger Woods brings when he tees it up in a tournament. But, you know, 48 years old, body seems to be hurting. There's just not many records that I feel that he still has a chance to break. But there's two that I think that are still in reach. And the one is, you know, winning for an 83rd time and beating Snead's record. And then coming up here at this Masters is breaking the all-time consecutive cuts made record. So right now he's tied at 23 with Gary Player and Fred Couples. And if he makes the cut at this Masters, then that's another record that he breaks and sets a new mark at 24 Masters in a row making the cut. That is just phenomenal.
You took the words out of my mouth about why Tiger matters this year. And I think, like, when you think about Tiger Woods, and he's obviously got the most records of any golfer that I think, I don't know if anybody will ever match the sheer number of records in my lifetime, in your lifetime, that Tiger set. It's hard to fathom that there will be somebody that comes through with this many records. And I think what makes Tiger such an icon of the sport, like so many other greats of any sport, is his ability to do the unthinkable, the unfathomable, when all the odds are stacked against him. And as you outlaid, he comes into this Masters having played 23 holes of golf.
It's crazy.
Competitive golf.
Crazy.
And he's going to tee it up at the golf course that is, you arguably need to be the most precise and sharp with your game. It's a physical test. It's a mental test. And here he's coming in this record. This isn't the biggest record. This isn't the most, you know, amazing record he's ever going to hold. But to break this record is and given the circumstances that he's in, is a unbelievable accomplishment if mm-hmm. he makes the cut this year.
Mm. Well, remember last year when he made the cut and then that weather rolled in on the Saturday? And I just remember vividly his second shot into the 14th hole, and we were on the air, and it was just bucketing down with rain. Yeah. And, you know, he's got the rain suit on and the umbrella and the hat, and there's just water everywhere. And he hit the shot, and walking over to his bag, which is like 5 yards away, the way he was walking, the pain that he was in just to get back to the golf bag was, like, that's an image I'll never, ever get out of my mind. You know, the fact that he went ahead and made the cut before having to withdraw on, you know, in that, after that third round or at some point in that third round was just, gosh, highlights how much pain he was in.
I'll never forget watching him walk up the 18th hill. It felt like he wasn't going to make it up. You know, yeah. I think physically with the leg, it seems like he's in a way better place now than last year.
Hope
I think
so.
it's just the reps, as he always has said. I mean, competitive reps really matter if you want to play high level golf.
And now we'll say this: if it's firm and fast, like I'm begging for, I think it improves his chances because he can use all of the experience and understanding of where you can leave the ball and still make a score. So firm and fast would be in his favor.
If it's firm and fast, I think that brings in that some of the guys that thrive are players that understand the golf course and then have magical short games.
Yeah.
So like if you're a Jordan Spieth fan, firm and fast to me would be where you, what you're really hoping for, because it allows him to have a little bit, in a way, it sounds counterintuitive, but the margins are smaller to make birdies, but they're wider if you've got just a extraordinary short game, in the sense of more guys are going to miss around the greens and it plays into your hands.
Yeah.
Right.
And
it's counterintuitive.
Record, yeah. And his record there is pretty, pretty dang stellar. That place absolutely suits him and gets him going. So.
All right, let's take a quick break to talk about another partner. This is a new partnership. This is, we used to have a Shotgun Start Coffee back in the day, and we've always wanted to get back into the coffee business, and we have partnered with Good Walk Coffee to create a fried egg coffee blend and a Shotgun Start coffee blend. So both of these coffee blends, we've got a light roast and a dark roast. The fried egg is a kind of a medium light roast. The Shotgun Start's a medium dark roast. It's really to appease both types of coffee drinkers. This is really good coffee. I was lucky to get to sample a bunch of coffees when we were finalizing this partnership. We tried out a lot of different blends. We kind of settled on these were our two favorites from the different genres. And really what this does is, you know, you buy our coffee, it goes to support the podcast. It's a consumable good. This, one of the virtues of coffee, I think in the modern era, you don't have to rely on going to the grocery store. At this point, you can get a subscription and just get it shipped out to you. And you never have that moment. You know, everybody like has that moment. It's 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night. And you're like, oh, I don't have coffee to make in the morning. So we've got all the options. You can get ground. You can get whole bean. The website to go visit is Good Walk Coffee. That's goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg. goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg. Go there. You can buy a single bag or you can subscribe and get it shipped to you so you never have to worry about it coming. That's goodwalkcoffee.com/friedegg. Thanks for the support, and now back to Trevor Immelman. My next one is going to be the live players. I've got three guys on the list, and I don't think it should surprise anyone. I'm not putting Joaquin Niemann in the mix until I see a top 10. Yeah,
ready for that.
Yeah. I want to see I want to see more. I know he played really well in that fall Masters during COVID. He was in the mix, but, you know, faltered late. Not all major records, when you look at Wikipedia, tell the true story. He was in the mix that year. That being said, I'm zeroed in on Brooks, Rahm, and Cam Smith. Cam Smith, we're 18 months removed effectively from him possibly being the best player in the world. He wasn't great in the last years. He wasn't terrible in the majors last year. He wasn't terrible. You know, what is he at this point is a question. I'll just run through these quick. You know, Rahm, I don't know if he, I think his decision to go to LIV, I think he went because he thought he was that the deal was done and he was coming back. And I don't know if he thought this was all going to be together or he was going to be playing PGA Tour events. But to me, Jon Rahm seems like a control freak. And I'm just curious about his prep. He's a world-class player. I think he can play well at Augusta with any prep. But I wonder about his prep and whether he's gotten to do exactly how he would want to prep for the Masters. And I don't necessarily think that he does. He's the reigning champion, defending champion, but he hasn't, you know, you think about last year coming into the Masters, he was undoubtedly the best player in the game. This year, he is without question not that in that same pedestal. And I think you saw that with that mano-a-mano showdown with Brooks. He knew he was the best player in the world. And Brooks, for the first time ever, kind of got out-alphaed on that kind of marathon Sunday. Jon Rahm,
second time if you count 2019 when Tiger got him.
Yeah, that's true. As I was going, I have that in the Brooks section. If you take Brooks's 2022 out of his majors just because of injuries, you know, he couldn't squat down to read a putt.
Yep.
He's got 17 top tens in his last 26 major starts.
That's awesome. It's awesome.
It includes 5 wins and 14 top fives.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And there's 3 top T6s in there. So if you went to T6, it'd be 17 top 6 finishes and 26 starts in majors. This guy, and I'm not a bettor. I don't really pay attention to betting odds very much. He's 20 to 1. He's 21 to 1, 20 to 1. How is this possible? He's been so close here. The Tiger year, it looked like the tournament was his. And then, you know, what happens on Sundays with Tiger Woods in the mix happened. You know, unless your name's Trevor Immelman. Yeah. And then last year, through 36, it looked like there was nobody that was going to beat this guy.
That's right.
If he wins, he has 6 majors. He's one leg away. If he wins this, I don't think there's like, I think that we have to start to look back, ignore the lack of other wins, and say this is the greatest player of the generation.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, there's not too much really that I can add to that. Rahm was my number two, my second biggest storyline leading in, so I guess I'll jump in on that. It is fascinating to me and exciting to me to be able to observe how this is going to unfold with him. Like you say, last year came in, he had played 8 PGA Tour events. He had won 3 of them. And he came to the Masters, won the green jacket, so that was his 4th win, and undoubtedly let the world know that he is the best player in the world. And now, after making this move, he's going to have played 5 live events after Miami this weekend. And if you do the math, because they play 3 round events, that'll be 17 less competitive rounds under his belt than what he played last year coming in to the Masters when he won. So is that going to mean anything? Like, we don't quite know yet. If you look at the 23 Masters, Brooks came in, we didn't quite know what he was doing. And like you say, after 36 holes, it didn't look like anyone was going to beat him. Mickelson finished 2nd out of nowhere. Like nowhere. And you got to give a shout out to Patrick Reed as well, who finished tied for 4th. So it didn't affect those guys having played less coming into last year's Masters. But that's not going to say that Jon Rahm's not going to feel a little different. And I am really, really fascinated to see how he handles the whole thing, what the reaction is going to be like, what those press conferences are going to be like, how he interacts with the media and other players that he hasn't seen for a long time. on the PGA Tour, and just what the dynamic is. It's gonna be lovely to watch.
Yeah. I mean, throw in. Do they have enough toilets around the course? You know, is he gonna be happy with that situation?
Now, Cam Smith, I see, just got rid of the mullet, so hopefully he doesn't lose any.
Oh, that was April. It was April Fool's.
Oh,
you
it
got,
was?
He got you. Yeah.
Oh man. Okay, I'm glad to hear it. You know, I don't want Cam losing any of those special short game powers. You know, the guy is a genius with a wedge and a putter in his hand, and in the same vein as Spieth, at a place like Augusta National, that is a massive weapon. So you always got to keep your eye on Cam Smith. And Brooks is an animal. Brooks is a major championship animal. As always, he hasn't played very well leading up to it or in the last few months, but does it really matter? Because when he pitches up to a major championship, he's able to just shift into another gear and get himself in contention.
To me, the only thing that matters with Brooks, if you go back through his career, so many of the times he's won majors is the week before. Does he turn up, and is the ball striking there? And so live Miami, like, I think that's the story, the thing to watch is Brooks Koepka on the leaderboard. If he's on the leaderboard, you got to feel great about what's going to happen, what him going into Augusta. It's like clockwork. I think it was Trinity Forest. He might finish fourth right before the PGA won. It's like if you go back last year, Crooked Caddy wins, and then he plays Augusta. He plays great. It's kind of like clockwork. That I think that's how you tell if Brooks is ready to go. Is the week before if he's in the mix. And I just I think that, you know, sneaky. We talk about Rory with Augusta National. Is Brooks actually the one that has been kind of snake bitten the most by Augusta and had the best chances to win? I think with the last 5 years, he's definitely, and I think, like, you talk about game for Augusta National, he's perfect. He's got everything you want, you know.
It just feels like it's more intense with Rory, though, because it's been for a longer period of time, you know, since 2011. I remember playing. Was 2011 was the one where he threw it away and Schwartzel birdied the last four holes, right? It's 2011, I'm quite sure. But I remember playing with Rory in the third or fourth round in 2009 when I was defending champion, and just watching this kid play this golf course going, he's going to win five of these. Like, this golf course is perfect for him. Back then, he played more of a draw, and I was just playing that round of golf with him that day going, man, this course is tailor-made for this guy. So the pressure feels a little bit more intense for me when it comes to McIlroy as opposed to Koepka.
With golf, I think there's, and particularly with Augusta National, I'm curious what you think about this, but to me, Augusta is the place that you have to swing more freely and without thought than anywhere else in the world. And there's going to be people on both sides of this which disprove and prove it. But to me, Augusta is the place where when you're over the ball, you have to let go of all your worries about where it might go, what it might do, and hit the shot, commit to the shot. And I think for some players, as you age, that becomes a harder and harder proposition. Your life, when you're 22, the things you worry about are so much less and so much less consequential than by the time you're 38 and you've got kids and you're worried, you know, like you become more trained as you age to worry more in a weird way. And I think this golf course, almost for some people, certain types of people versus other types of people, becomes more difficult to play because of that.
Mm. Are you connecting that with Rory?
I don't know. I think it's just certain personalities, right? Where I think there's with young players, and I think like Spieth's a great example, not at Augusta, just in general in his career. I think golf's gotten harder for him as he's aged, and he thinks about more stuff. It's not as when you're, I remember when Adam Scott.
Well, it's not always that he thinks about more, but he definitely knows more.
Yes. And knowledge can be, it goes back to that Harrington quote, experiences and everything.
Yeah.
When you think about Adam Scott, when they changed the rule about flagstick putting and he started putting with the flagstick in, he had this great putting year. And he talked about how it reminded him as a kid when he used to just sit on the putting green and bang putts into the flagsticks, the little flagsticks on a putting green, and how it made it easy because it connected back to when you didn't think about things.
Sure.
And I think that Augusta, because of all the things we outlined right at the top, like all these little things, and you have to figure out what you're doing with a shot. And then forget about everything and hit the shot.
Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot that's going on. You know, we touched on the lies. It's absolutely in your mind how much or how small the space is that you need to land your ball on approach shots. And then the swirling wind is really the icing on the cake from a standpoint of sowing doubt. So when you know that you have this small space that you need to land your ball in to give yourself a good look, and you're not 100% sure where the wind is, that it's a problem. It's a problem.
Since we've touched on Rory here, I know Rory's on your list.
Rory's
I know
my he's number on my, three. More, Rory's my number three.
So we're here. Let's talk about him.
Okay.
What
tenth
do you got?
Time, tenth go at trying to complete the Grand Slam. If he does, I actually think it, you know, if you've got this Rory and Brooks rivalry, really of, you know, who's the best player of this generation. If Rory goes ahead and wins the Masters, completes the Grand Slam, it gives him that slight edge over Brooks. Because
variety of courses that he's won at.
Wow, Brooks but is also, like, that is the most elite list in golf. I mean, in golfing history, for Rory to be only the sixth guy to do that, I mean, that is like, that's rarefied air right there. And it's so interesting to see how he goes about it. It's not like he's played badly. He's had seven top tens in the last 10 years at the Masters. So he's had a few opportunities there and thereabout, but this year feels a little different because normally he's won by now, he's played well, but this year he really hasn't played well. He won in Dubai earlier on in the season. And then in his five starts on the PGA Tour, T19 at the Players is his best finish. That is, it's unheard of for Rory McIlroy. So I'm wondering, like, does this take some pressure off? Does this take some of the spotlight off? These are all interesting things. And then, you know, he's been putting in a little work with Butch Harmon for the last few weeks. How does that change things? He's spoken about, you know, earlier on the season, missing left with the driver, seemed to fix that, then started missing with the irons, hasn't had a week where he's really put everything together. Now, if there was one coach that I would have recommended for Rory, it would have been Butch Harmon for sure. Because Butch has an amazing ability to give a player confidence without changing too much. And he has a knack for that. He did it with Fowler last year, and he's done it with multiple players throughout his career. He is a mastermind of getting the best out of highly talented golfers. So it's going to be fun to see how Rory pitches up and how he goes about it. And, you know, we'll probably get an early look here this week at San Antonio if anything looks a little different. But let me just finish by saying this. My belief is Rory plays Augusta National too aggressively. And that's what gets him undone all the time. And I just wish that he would take his foot off the gas a little bit and let the golf course come to him rather than going out trying to birdie every hole. You know, I remember last year in the first round, afternoon tee times, I'm sitting in Butler Cabin. I got Jim Nance to my left. Rahm steps up. It's the southwest wind helping off the left on number one. Okay, you've got about 280 or so to that fairway bunker down the right-hand side. Rahm steps up, perfect club choice, five wood, lays it up just short left of the bunker. He's got a 7-8 iron into the green, middle green. Okay, he had a bit of a nightmare on the green. He four-putted or what have you, but and got off to the poor start. But Rory steps up straight to the driver. He's got the helping wind. The beauty of the design on number one is the widest part of the fairway is in front of that fairway bunker. And as you start pushing it past the bunker, the pine trees on the left creep in at an angle. So he's now
and
trying
the fairway moves at an angle too. Correct. That fairway isn't a straight fairway. It's an angled fairway where you have to hit the exact line and distance control. It becomes a two-part question.
Exactly. So now he's trying to fit a driver into a extremely narrow place on the first shot of the tournament. There's no point in doing it. Absolutely no point in doing it. He ends up hitting a 8 out of 10 tee shot straight into the trees on the left because he's run through and he's run out of space. And I look over at Jim Nantz and I'm like, what is he doing hitting driver there? And those are the sort of things that I just wish he would let the golf course come to him a little bit more. And I think back to something that Jack Nicklaus said to me. And I never had the talent and ability to use this strategy, but McIlroy does. And Jack said to me, look, when I was in my prime, I knew that I was the best. And I didn't have to do anything special to have a chance to win with nine holes because I knew that I was the best. And McIlroy has that at his disposal. He does not need to go out there and do anything crazy to have a chance with nine holes to play on Sunday.
I think he played so aggressive last year. He played so aggressive at Oak Hill the next event, which I think Oak Hill was like beneficial to play aggressive in spots. Mm. I thought his game plan for LACC was spectacular.
Perfect. You know what? I told him that.
What he did is he hit less drivers. He hit a lot of three woods. His three wood goes as far as the best players in the world's drivers go. Mm-hmm. And he finds more fairways. And from the fairway, the thing about Rory is going to run into birdies. Yep. Left and right.
I mean, it would be so unbelievably good.
If he plays from the fairway or with clear shots into greens the vast majority of time, he's going to make 4-5 birdies at Augusta National almost every round. And from those positions, he's going to limit his bogeys. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, you've hit the nail on the head. It's not for Rory, it's not about. It's never this in this whole major drought. It hasn't been about the ability to score on a golf course. It's been about the ability to limit the backbreakers, the momentum killers. And I know some people don't believe in momentum golf.
No,
when you make an 8 footer for par, and you go to the next tee, it feels like a birdie. And I think so much of Rory is about keeping the card cleaner. Because, you know, with the par fives at Augusta National, his length, his talent, his skill, there's three birdies, easy birdies per round. Maybe you don't hit a great drive on one of them and it becomes, you know, a par hole. But
sure.
Three of the four, you're going to have a shot. If you're driving it halfway decent, even with your three wood, you're going to have an easy shot into the green and a chance to make birdies. And you're going to run into a couple others. Yep. So, you know, I think I like his game plan this year of he's coming in late, I think Tuesday. He's skipping the par three. He's done his prep work this week.
Poppy's not going to be happy about that.
No. Poppy might be happy. I've got a daughter about the same age. Poppy might be happier getting to sit in front of a TV and watch TV. You know,
there's nothing like that part three, man. It's the best.
So I like the strategy that he's employing this year, where it seems to me he's approaching it more like just another tournament. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you're looking for positive signs at the players, he made a ton of birdies. And I think that's valuable for somebody. That's what Rory's secret sauce is that the guy can make more birdies than anybody else in the world when it's going. Now, the flip side is he made a ton of big numbers, and that's been the Achilles heel all year. It's been the big numbers, the big mistakes.
But they kind of go hand in hand, don't they? I mean, if you're playing that aggressively, you're going to make a ton of birdies, but you're going to make sixes and sevens as well, which he does more than any great player I've ever seen. And that's what I'm saying. Like, he's going to make birdies. He's going to make birdies regardless. And as far as the prep goes and playing nine holes and not playing the par three or playing and not playing the week before, I don't actually even care about any of that. I care more about what is he going to do on Thursday when it matters. He needs to not play as aggressively. And he needs to let the golf course come to him and open up for him and just play every shot on its own merit without, like, when the hole location is on the left corner on three, dump it out to 30 feet right. When the hole location is back right on four, hit it 40 feet in the middle of the green and make a par and get out there. When the hole location is back right on five, hit it towards the bunker and putt up the hill from 30 feet. Those are not birdie opportunities. Make pars. Wait till you get to a spot where you can actually be aggressive. And it is on the par fives, and it's in a couple of situations to easier hole locations on the threes and fours. But let the golf course come to you. You are that good. You don't need to do anything special. Just play normal golf.
Yeah, I agree. To go to the next guy on my list,
yeah,
guy that plays maybe normal golf better than anybody in the world, who's hitting the ball better than anybody in the world, is Scottie Scheffler.
So he's my number one storyline.
Obviously, he comes into this with win second, on a, you know, really a 18-month plus run where the ball striking's been at a level that only has been matched by Tiger Woods. I think the big question is for me is going to be, is the putter a Band-Aid, or has a new putter changed the way he putts? Because in the last few years, I don't think the putter's been, it's been a stroke/mental thing. And I just, you know, it's one putt, but I do wonder about that putt at Houston and how it sticks with him. If he putts average, I have a hard time believing that anybody's going to beat him.
Yeah. If he putts average, generally it's over. That's all he needs is to not lose strokes. The putt on 18 on Sunday bothered me too. I know there's a lot of pressure that he's running on high confidence right now, but he's supposed to make that putt. And when people throw these comparisons with the Tiger-like run, Tiger-like ball striking, let me tell you what Tiger would have done. He would have buried that putt. He would have been dancing around the green, giving uppercut fist pumps. And then he would have birdied the first playoff hole to win the Houston Open. So, it's always tricky when you make these comparisons because we want to see another Tiger so badly because we had so much fun. Well, I was getting my brains beat in by him. But as golf fans, so much fun watching this extraordinary athlete.
I go back to the three putt also that in that tournament. There's two putting moments that why he hasn't won three in a row. And I listen, I don't want this to come across as nitpicky, but when you're the best player in the world, that's what analyzing the best player in the world becomes. You see all the shots, you see the moments, and there's, you know, that field at Houston is an event that the greats of all time win those events. You're expected to, and it's hard. But when I look at the putt on 18, the day that he three putted,
yeah,
people are brushing it off as that short putt was was just a lapse in concentration. A, that doesn't happen with Tiger if you want to do the Tiger comparisons. But B, I think that was like, that was the putt. That's the thing that he's been struggling with, where that putter face opens a little bit and you miss those putts on the right. If you watch that short, the putter face is open. And then the flip side of when you're having that problem and you know on short putts, I just don't release it. I don't square it. Then what happens is you have that pull, that soft pull. And that's what that putt on 18 was. It was a soft pull, the putt to tie.
The backswing looked so short and rushed to me in real time. I haven't watched it again. So I will go ahead and say that. But I was watching live, and you know, if I was on the call, I said it out loud as soon as I watched the putt. I said to my son, "How short was that backswing?" Like, it was, there was almost no backswing, and then he was like trying to find the face through impact. And for a right to left putt to have that thing look like it started kind of inside left, if we're being generous, maybe more left edge, it sure wasn't pretty. But let's switch this to the positive side. 6 out of his last 7 events, he has been positive strokes gained putting for the week. Okay. And since he's gone to this mallet, in these 3 events, he's been positive strokes gained putting. And we just touched on, if he can keep that around average for the week, there's probably only 3 guys that have a chance to beat him. It's Koepka, McIlroy, and Rom. So it'll be interesting to see. The other thing that is just so amazing about him is his demeanor and his mental outlook and approach. You know, a lot of people out there say that it's not exciting and he doesn't show enough personality and what have you. And I can see that side of it. I mean, it's entertainment at the end of the day for fans. But gosh, it's solid, man. It's solid. He doesn't get too high. He doesn't get too low. And when you start coming to major championship golf, when it is draining physically, emotionally, mentally, to have that sort of mental approach that Scotty does, in a lot of ways, it's how Brooks is at the majors.
Yeah.
You know, those guys are able to conserve so much more energy and keep some gas in the tank for just in case they're really going to need to do something special with 9 holes to play. His mental approach is, it's on the money. It is on the money. The way he handles the media, the way he answers the questions, the way he never beats himself up. It's really, really good.
He's an extraordinary player from if you just study, he's how everybody who's played tournament golf would dream of playing tournament golf. In terms of the way he maneuvers a golf course, it's just, I feel like he never puts himself at undue risk. And what you said, there's like an aspect of tournament golf that doesn't get talked about enough is stress management.
Yeah.
When you're playing around, I think about Molinari's final round with Tiger in 2019, that final round. Everybody's rooting for Tiger. And I remember it maybe off of 6 green. It's like, when is this guy going to make a bogey with like where he's been? He wasn't playing well, but he was pulling together these pars and it looked like it just wasn't going to stop. But the stress level on that round was so high through 6 holes, through 9 holes, through 12 holes. When you get all that stress, eventually you're going to crack.
Yep.
And it's just, you cannot play 4 rounds of golf like that. You can't, it's hard to play 1 round of golf where you are piecing it all together. You're trying to, you know, get up and down here. You've got a 5-footer here, a 6-footer here, a 7-footer here for par. And what Scotty does so well is with the demeanor, with never getting too high, never getting too low, and the way he plays a golf course, he just never puts himself into too many situations, you know, and really the situations that have been the crux of his issue is like, I have 4 feet for par the last, you know, year and a half. That's been his stressor. It's not been anything tee to green. And part of it is unbelievable striking of the ball. The other part of it is what we talked about with Rory, is not putting himself into positions to have big numbers.
Mm. His course management is awesome. It's the best out there right now. Out of this crop of players that are playing at the highest level right now, Scheffler has the best course management strategy, understanding of where to put the ball, understanding of when to hit what shots. I mean, think about that 18th hole at the Players.
Yeah.
You know, a few weeks ago. How he gears down to the 3-wood. You know, everyone always talks about the go-to fade. Nope. He turns a little high, right to left 3-wood, right down the right half. Perfect wedge to 15 feet. Hit a pretty good putt there.
And yeah, great putt.
That didn't go in. But the guy is, he's the man right now. He's the best player in the world. I don't think it's particularly close at this point. And with how good his iron play is and how good his iron play has been for going on 3 years, if we circle all the way back to the beginning of this conversation and hoping for firm and fast, if it gets firm and fast with the control that he has over shape, trajectory, and spin with his irons, he will be extremely hard to beat.
Yeah, I agree. I think he's the favorite, and for all intents and purposes, it's hard to see how you could pick somebody else given the run. The floor, to me, like the thing that's crazy with Scheffler is like the floor is if he plays bad, he's fourth or fifth or sixth.
Yeah, last year, I believe, he was I'm wanting to say tied for 10th and dead last in putting.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. It's insane stuff. Last one before we get you out of here.
I got one more too.
Oh, you got one more. What's yours?
You go ahead.
All right. I've got a list of players, and you know, I think it's insane that the fourth ranked player in the world is playing his first Masters.
Yeah, I think we're onto the same thing here. So let's hear it.
Well, it's like the fourth ranked player in the world. Has this ever happened where we've had a top five player making their debut at the Masters?
Shucks, not that I can recall, Andy.
We've got two guys in the top 10. Yeah. Two of the top 10 players in the world, and this goes to some of the problems with the world rankings right now. But I would have a hard time believing there'd be more than maybe Joaquin Niemann and Cam Smith are two players that could be in the top 10, you know, but and Brooks. So there's three players, maybe, but two of the top 12 players in the game right now are first timers at Augusta. It's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
It really is. And so this was my number 4 storyline. So you and I were thinking along the same lines. 1979, the famous Fuzzy Zeller playoff win, is the last time that a first timer won the Masters. But these two have a shot. These two have a legitimate shot. Awesome players. Wyndham Clark has, in the last year, turned into like a big game hunter. You know, he does not win small events. Like, he wins on tough golf courses against the best players. You think of LACC, you think of the Wells Fargo, you think of the 60 at Pebble. I know we didn't have a final round there, but still, like, this guy wins big time tournaments and was obviously right in the mix with Scotty at API and Players. So,
the guy has some gas off the tee. I don't think it gets talked about enough, but I was out with his group with Rory and at Genesis. I mean, there were a few times where he hit it 10, 15 past Rory.
Yeah,
there were other times where, I mean, like, I think into the wind, Rory had a better ball flight. Like, his might spin up a little bit more, but I mean, I don't think he gets enough credit for how long he is, like prodigious length off the tee.
Yeah, I think when they are both just cruising with the driver, which is different to mere mortals cruising. But when they're both just cruising, Wyndham has probably got two or three more miles an hour ball speed than Rory. He gets up into that, you know, 186, 187, 188, which Rory has, but he doesn't really get to that too often on the course. He's more in the 83, 84 zone. But that's the one thing that is my concern with Wyndham Clark at Augusta National. Because there's a few times during the round, he's going to need to, at the very least, have a straight drive. Whereas even though he bombs it a mile, he puts quite a lot of curve from left to right on it with the driver.
Yes.
So there's a few times I'm thinking of 2, I'm thinking of 9, I'm thinking of 13, I'm thinking of 14, where if the ball starts to leak to the right, he's 10. Not going to have much space. Yeah, but 10, he can just rope the 3-wood.
Yeah.
Or even a driving iron for as far as he hits the ball. So 10 is like a... 10 is like a specialty shot. It's almost like when you're behind a tree and you know you've got to hit a 20-yard hook. That tee shot is like a specialty shot. Guys generally find a way to pull it off. But some of those others that are a bit more subtle that I mentioned, he's going to have to be careful not to run out down the right-hand side and get himself into some trouble. But he has proved to us he is not scared. He's got the guts. He has a ton of self-belief. His mental game is as good as anybody's out there right now. It's wonderful to watch him, see how quickly he bounces back mentally from bad shots and gets on with it. He's gonna be an interesting one to watch there, being a first-timer.
Yeah, I think that. And then Ludvig, obviously, great yep. driver. I something you were saying when I was thinking, one thing I was thinking about is like it's been etched into our brain how important distance is at Augusta National. And it's important everywhere. But I think this era of players, almost everybody's long enough, plenty long to play there. And it's become an underrated control course.
Yeah, look, for me, I've always thought that it was a second shot approach play, elite level approach play that is going to win you the Masters. You know, you've got to drive the ball well, don't get me wrong, but you can get away with some things and there's certain areas where you have a bit of space to where it's not mega intimidating like old school US Opens that I used to play where we had 20-yard wide fairways and 8-inch rough. It's not like that. You can conjure up shots from out of pine straw. You can, you know, hit some running shots out of the second cut. You have some options if you hit some squirrely tee shots. But high level approach play is the thing that really gives you a good shot at Augusta National.
That's my concern with Ludvig. Is
okay,
the approach play.
I know that stats wise he's. It's not his strength.
I thought the Ryder Cup is what sticks with me. Mm. A lot of uneven lies, a lot of, you know, where you, I wasn't out there, but some of the terrain I thought was actually kind of similar with the Master, with Augusta National in the sense of like the severity. And I just thought under the gun in intense pressure, the thing that I walked away from that event going was the approach play has a long way to go. And that's my concern with the Masters.
Yeah. I'm less concerned with the approach play and a little bit more concerned with the putting for him. And here's why. He seems to putt really aggressively speed wise. And I've just never seen anybody have too much luck with that at Augusta National. Especially, you know, when I watch him hit 3, 4, 5 footers, eesh, I mean, he's shrinking the hole, man. That thing has got a ton of speed on it. And the edges are so sharp and the greens get so fast that if you put a ton of speed on one and it rims out, you're going to have 5 or 6 feet coming back.
Also, where the holes are on these little tricky spots where it's like this little like knoll where where the ball runs away in all these directions. So it amplifies the miss.
Totally. Totally.
All right. We got through our five things.
Yeah, we did.
Who's your pick to win?
Scheffler.
Yeah, I think it's hard not to pick Scheffler.
It's hard not to. It's really hard not to. Hit the run that he's on. Like I say, the mental approach, he's not going to tie himself up in knots this week when he's at home. You know, he's probably out. He loves playing pickleball and tennis, and he's probably out there just having a good time with his buddies and doing a little practice. He's not going to get all wound up. Like, he's just so cool, so calm. He's the best iron player in the game, hits the ball a mile. He works it both ways off the tee if he needs it. He has the experience of winning there. He's coming in winning two massive tournaments. It's just so hard to pick anybody other than him.
All right, that's Trevor Immelman, lead analyst. We'll hear you on the telecast. Congrats on the start to the year. I think CBS has taken what they've built the last few years. Is just, you guys have done such a great job, and this year you've made the coverage even better. And I can't wait to see what you guys have up your sleeve for this year's Masters.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. We are so excited. The team has been in constant contact throughout this period. You know, we're a little lightly run. We've only had three events so far this season, and the Sunday of Pebble Beach was rained out. So
You're in a similar situation to Rom.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. We're chomping at the bit. We're ready to get down there and have an amazing week. It's a huge week for us at CBS, if you don't mind me saying this.
Go for it.
You know, our chairman, Sean McManus, is retiring, and this is his final event as chairman of CBS Sports. This is his 28th Masters. He took over in 97. He's been an unbelievable leader. And then Vern Lundquist is retiring. This will be his 40th Masters. The most amazing calls, historic calls at Augusta National have been made by Vern. So it's a huge week for us to get down to Augusta and the Masters, and then we go on a long run all the way through the regular season.
It's gonna be sad. You know, I think obviously Sean's in the background, but with Vern, it's gonna be tough not having Vern after this year. He's especially, I mean, I think like the greats really age well, and he's aged so gracefully with the calls. You know, they aren't always as sharp as they once were, but they are so memorable, and he's just got a voice and a timing for the moment, you know.
Yep.
And I think that's what all the greats have, is that ability to say the thing that you're feeling that you would never yourself be able to pull out into words.
Yeah, he's a legend. He is a legend. He's a Jack Nicklaus. He's a Tiger Woods. He's an Arnold Palmer. Like, in broadcasting, you know, he's up there. He is up there. And I always have this little chuckle. We did a media call the other day, and he was telling the story about what was going through his mind before he made the call on 17 in 1986 when Jack made that putt. And he said, as he was sort of trying to figure out what his strategy was going to be, you know, as Jack was playing the 17th hole, he said he came up with the idea, keep it simple and get your butt out of the way. And I was thinking to myself, you know, that's somebody that really understood the moment. We're at the Masters. This is the greatest player to ever live. He's 46 years old. He's about to and trying to win his sixth green jacket. There is no need for an announcer to be filling the air up with whatever. Keep it simple and get your butt out of the way. And that's Vern in a nutshell. He's just a legend.
I think that is a amazing piece of advice in general.
Yeah.
For life. Keep it simple get out of the way. If you just followed that for the rest of your life, I feel like you'd get into a good spot.
Yep.
It's
been awesome to join you, man. Thanks so much. I'm a huge fan of the pod, you know, what you do here at the Fried Egg and Shotgun Start and all the other different bits and pieces you guys have got going.
Thank you, Trevor. I'm looking forward to seeing you next week in Augusta. So I'll see you there. And thank you so much for coming on. Big time fan. So,
all right. Have a good one.
All right. Again, big thanks to Trevor. I can't thank him enough for coming on and doing this. I know he's super busy with all the things he does the week of the Masters. So this was a real treat to get him on. Big thanks to Matt Ruches for editing and producing this podcast, especially while he's been on the road. He's been doing a big tour of South Carolina golf. And a lot of that stuff that he's been touring, we're going to have write-ups in Club TFE in the near future from this South Carolina trip. Also, just kind of coming soon in Club TFE, I've got two profiles that I'm finishing up, one of which is on Augusta National. Club TFE is our membership. It's $120 for the year, and we do a ton of content in there. We do every week. There's a tour guide, which is a PGA Tour professional golf focused write-up. And then twice a week, we have golf architecture. We have a course review every week and design notebook every week, which dives into like what's going on in the design world. So subscribe, join Club TFE. There's a bunch of other benefits. It's $120 a year. And I love the community that we're building in there. So really proud of it. We've got Augusta National profile. By me saying this, it means I have to get it done. And County Louth Beltre, a great Tom Simpson design in Ireland. So Beltre will be up hopefully this week too. I think just depending on time, that is going to be done before the Augusta National profile. It'll just be a matter of when we get it posted. So those two profiles will be coming to you next week or the next 2 weeks in Club TFE. So join there. We love our members, and we're looking to add a bunch of stuff to that membership over the course of the year and the coming years. So thanks, and can't wait for Masters coverage. I hope everybody's got great Masters plans, and we'll be back. Garrett and I are recording a podcast actually on Sunday, the day this episode came out. We're recording a podcast for later in the week. That we'll be going through each hole at Augusta National, ranking them one through 18. It'll be a fun exercise. I'm excited to see where we differ and where we align. So thanks, and I hope we have a great Masters. I hope everybody has a great Masters. ¶¶